A little early, but I would like to begin so that we can give plenty of time to Duane to make the presentation, and then we'll have a little time for questions and answers before lunch. I do want to remind you, too, tonight we have another fireside chat. It will begin at 9:30. And then we'll go until at least 10:30 at the fireside chat, and gives us more opportunity to engage more personally in conversation with our speakers. But again, let's welcome Dr. Duane Larson to the podium, and we really thank you for being with us, Duane.
Thank you again, Bob, and good morning to all of you. I've noticed a few people wearing loud banners about a certain seminary, so I wore my coat. Show you that we have something of a postmodern symbol of Wartburg that's actually the long live symbol that we gather from Gregory of Nyssa. I'm sure you can see it very clearly. Two dolphins on either side of the cross, and the cross having overcome the serpent of evil. The dolphins representing the playful and wise creation. And of course, the cross as the triumph over sin and death and evil. It's something I like very much. I'm saying that only because I have a little bit of an institutional agenda at the moment. But then I'm going to get into a bit of postmodern commentary as I try to get my mind into our task for this morning. The institutional business for the moment is, I notice that there is a righteous remnant within this group of Wartburg alums and friends and people who might be interested in associating with Wartburg and so on and so forth. There, I say that with all due respect and to my alma mater and to other seminaries who make up a very important distinctive voices in the ecology of seminary education. But there are people from Wartburg or people interested in Wartburg who have talked to me about trying to get together sometime while here who can't make a particular kind of luncheon on Friday afternoon. So I want to say if there are those of you who would like to get together with me, say, just outside the dining hall at 1 o'clock, raise your hands. That's a really overwhelming amount. Are there any who want to do that later? Say later in the afternoon around 4:30 or so. Okay, good, it's off. All right. So that gives me a little liberation from having to conduct the stereotypical presidential business. But if there is anyone who wants to be interested, of course, catch me sometime in between sessions. I mentioned this is also kind of postmodern, this little symbol, because there are two characteristics. I'm not going to talk about postmodernity in itself today, but two characteristics of postmodern consciousness that are kind of interesting. One is that those who would see themselves as postmodern, whatever that is, generally are given to accessing early Christian sources these days more than had been the case, as authorities for doing new theology. So they're going back to the ancient fathers and mothers, as well as to a recapturing of some minority voices in liturgy and spirituality and prayer, like Hildegard of Bingen and Julian of Norwich and so forth. That's a fascinating thing to me. The other piece, which I will obliquely touch on in a more parochial conversation on justification, is how postmodernity attempts to overcome the so-called object-subject split by thinking more holistically, or at least thinking tensively, to recognize that require the both in a kind of a complementary relationship, so to get at something that is yet bigger. I was introduced to postmodernity in a riveting way when I arrived in Iowa, just before the famed Iowa caucuses. Now, remember, I've been a Californian, then I've been on the East Coast, so I'm going through a bit of cultural adjustment. and recognized that postmodernity had really rooted in the heartland when a fellow drove by on Highway 20 going east in a Mercedes, a business type person. One bumper sticker said, "Steve Forbes for president." The other said, "9-inch nails." Now, about 3/4 of us don't know what 9-inch nails is. But the sheer contradiction of those two bumper stickers told me that if this person can hold it together, he's truly a postmodern. 9-inch nails is kind of a grunge industrial rock group that makes music by playing chainsaws, according to my hearing. But to hold that together, you see, in a very experimental form of music, and with something so ostensibly conserving as a Steve Forbes, well, that tension was very interesting to me, and that says something about postmodernity. Postmodernity is also touched upon somewhat when people access quantum physics to argue toward a new kind of religious expression. I first caught that vision, its promise as well as its irresponsibility, many, many years ago in a book you might remember by Fritjof Capra, The Dancing Wuli Masters. I thought, boy, there's really interesting stuff going on here, and that really was a formal catalyst for my interest in theology and science. But what also disturbed me was an evident too quick a religious delineation out of quantum principles. And I wondered just how might this be more responsibly appropriated. After which I became introduced to folks like John, who were beginning to write, by my lights, more responsibly in the area. But sort of a quantum postmodern view is caught in a joke, so I've got to tell a joke, of course, that John prompted in me when he mentioned the other night some things about quantum epistemology, that there are some who would say the very act of observation calls something into existence. That's sort of also a postmodern trait these days, too. The joke is about three umpires. You know this one, okay. We'll call one a Kantian umpire, the other one a realist umpire, and the third, for lack of a better term, quantum idealist umpire, or just say postmodern. The Kantian umpire said, "I call things as I see them." So a bit of humility there about, you know, distinguishing between the reality and the appearance. The realist says, "I call things as they are." And the postmodern umpire says, "They ain't nothing until I calls them." Kind of a big leap in trying to overcome subject-object split and all the problems about that. Maybe that'll come to mind as I try to get at some of that issue with regard to the doctrine of justification, which itself has kind of a strange history of being subjected to objective versus subjective interpretations. And in the history of the doctrine of justification, since Luther till now, we've seen it go both ways, and probably now are just getting out of what I would call an overly objective interpretation of doctrine of justification. And by the way, the lights for this were also inspired in me, and I'm sure for many of you, in the late work of Joe Sittler, who started but didn't have the opportunity to complete rumination on connection between justification and healthy ecology. You remember his interests were going that way, but he wanted to find some direct lines that would unpack justification in something more meaningful than just the moral or subjectivist perspective or a simply objectivist perspective. So we're going to talk a bit about that today and see if we can overcome that, but after having done some fairly dry historical overview. I want to do that, you see, toward the point, again, of arguing that justification is about something real. And we've heard this repeated now in many different ways in our 2.5 days or so already together. But to speak of justification is even something like a metaphysical principle, or at least it begs or implies some metaphysical claims. The doctrine of justification, of course, is summarized in Augsburg Confession 4. I'll simply quote it, do my duty here, and then we'll move on. It is taught that we cannot obtain forgiveness of sin and righteousness before God through our merit, work, or satisfaction, but that we receive forgiveness of sin and become righteous before God out of grace for Christ's sake through faith when we believe that Christ has suffered for us and that for his sake our sin is forgiven and righteousness and eternal life are given to us. For God will regard and reckon this faith as righteousness in God's sight. That's where we really land when we would underscore the objective side of things. It's as if here one could see in the article on justification, the article, of course, on which the church stands or falls, but it's not the only article that the church bespeaks. It implies a whole larger complex of assumptions like Trinity in order for justification to make any possible sense. But in that last sentence, for God will regard and reckon this faith as righteousness in his sight, some have said, well, before postmodernity comes along, that they ain't nothing until God calls them. I think that there's a lot of promise in that. And the promise is especially when we are subjected to the futility of our own subjectivity. When we are caught in the moment and cannot see the larger frame. Already I'm hyperlinking, as I say, to other issues here, and I'm getting off script. But something was going on very trenchantly in the conversation that Susan catalyzed about theology of the cross and proclamation and how do we see any possible change or promise any real change in the parishioner who is so subjected? At least the proclamation means, understood by that last line of the article on justification, that there is a larger frame that needs to be objectively stated to the one in pain, because the one in pain can't see the forest for the trees. So it's cradling, as Susan calls it, is one wonderfully appropriate way of bespeaking it. The other appropriate way is to remember that we are always, when with respect to the doctrine of justification, doing pastoral care and metaphysical assertion by giving the larger real frame to what the parishioner thinks is only going on subjectively. That's why Luther was so clear that this is, first of all, a matter of pastoral care, that there is always an other. I like to rap about it, the objectification of justification. That's what he was about. He caught something right there. There's always an other that is required to bring home the message. Okay? But bringing home the message in that fashion, while implying a metaphysical thing, is not to say only that the metaphysics of justification are about God's activity out there only as the other. There is also something that has to be attended to, delightfully underscored in a phrase, second verse of the first song that Susan had us sing, about Christ's reign, as in from the skies, infused to us. There is also, both and, something subjectively necessary that the objective claim can help us remember and find our center in. Well, as I say, I've hyperlinked already. I've shown my cards perhaps too early of what I want to try to get at and to overcome. But we can take the doctrine of justification and go either sense and miss something important, even while we have already claimed homiletically there, done something pastoral counseling-wise there, very, very important. Let's do a little bit of history here. And this also turns on a kind of a fateful way of approaching the Lutheran confessions. One way of approaching the Lutheran confessions, which characterizes probably most of us here, is to understand the Augsburg Confession, to some degree the Apology, but the Augsburg Confession and the Catechisms as the canons within the canon of Lutheran confessions, right? About which we understand the rest of the canon of the Book of Concord as exegesis. There's another way to look at it, and how you go might make all the difference in how you even then speak of justification. You might also look then finally at the last thing as the most definitive thing said, as if following through on the debate that was required in the pounding out of the confessions, that finally in 1584 we have nailed down what Luther really meant. Right? Not unlike saying that that last line of the book of Revelation is what Jesus really meant. So the telos is the meaning, not what initiated the conversation. That's an important piece. Wherever you fall on interpretation about justification, think about where you enter into the canon there. All right? Because a faithful piece about understanding justification turns on solid declaration of the formula of Concord, Article 3. Now, I know we're all really jazzed about getting into that. It was only last night that we all read it, right? Let's go back at that. Article 3 is about righteousness of solid declaration. It's really an explication of understanding of how justification got done. And there was an argument going on around Andreas or Andrew Osiander, who said justification gets done because the divine nature of Christ kind of comes into one and is infused into one like a blue gas, and that initiates, that catalyzes, that's a real metaphysical origin for justification of the individual. Now, it's important that I said, because that's what Osiander said, this divine nature that he claimed resided in the individual, that's communicated to the individual by God. And that's what makes for justification. That itself is already kind of a compromised Christology. There were others that said, no, Andrew, you're all wrong. Others like Martin Chemnitz, who tried to argue that it's really more a matter of the whole Christ, divine and human nature of Christ, residing, taking habitation, even pitching a tent, some people preached in that way, inside the human being. But that didn't go down well either, with particularly the Gnasio Lutherans who won the point in an interesting alliance, one of the few times in history where they allied with the Philippists, those who followed Melanchthon. Melanchthon and the Gnasio Lutherans on this score were united in saying that we have to keep our emphasis on the extranos side, that is, on the objective side of justification, so that it not be confused with subjectivity, that it not be possibly confused in any way with semi-Pelagianism, that idea that somehow we could cooperate in our redemption. And so they made the assertion that the forensic theory, or implied even, that the forensic theory of atonement, where God declares it so, is the only one that's workable here. God has got to be outside, as it were, to use geographical language. It is God's utterance, utterly unfettered, that makes for justification. And then whatever happens on the inside is a consequence of that. But it's only, they were trying to say, effect. It is not God in God's self. Do you hear where that's going? How that is a very interesting and in a certain respect, strategically, in certain cases, correct way of putting it. It's strategically important to put it that way when one is in bondage to subjectivity, which, of course, we find ourselves fairly often in such a state. Now, that is a little bit of a turn from what Luther so often stated about Christ in us. It becomes difficult for those who've claimed that overly forensic side, to account for how Luther, in so many different ways, talked about God giving God's self to the believer. God initiates it utterly unfetteredly in God's aseity, God's freedom. But God also comes to, in, with, under the believer. That's the affective side that Susan has so wonderfully been leading us in. And sometimes, perhaps, if we wonder what's going on affectively and have question about it, maybe at that point we're too caught up on the objective side of the tension. Luther himself, it seems, wanted to go somewhere else. And many argue today would not have gone to quite so refined a notion of justification as thoroughly objectified or objectivized. Luther put it this way, quotes, "An excellent promise is given that we too are to partake of the divine nature and be so highly ennobled that we are not only to be loved by God through Christ, possessing his favor and grace as the highest, most cherished sanctuary, but are to have him, the Lord himself, dwelling in us entirely." What an amazing statement. And how contradictory that could seem to that other, more forensic, strategically stated version of justification. The claim that Christ is present in the Christian and occupies a far greater place in the thought of Luther, it seems, than in the thought of Lutheranism that followed. And so one writes, "The idea of a divine life in Christ who is really present in faith lies at the very center of the theology of the Reformer." I'll read that again. The idea of a divine life in Christ who is really present in faith lies at the very center of the theology of the Reformer. Little sidebar, if you go back, and email me if you do, because I'd be interested to see it happen. It'd be a marvelous kind of thing to do, although I don't expect it. Our lives are demanded, or our ministry is demanded in other directions. If you go back to Article 3 of the Solid Declaration, note an interesting little tension going on between two words, favor and gift. Favor et donum in the Latin. You know, they're doing the scholastic method here, so they got to do it in Latin, and they go to great extremes to parse the terms. The Solid Declaration landed, according to the majority opinion on that time, there in Article 3, on the side of favor, and tried to distinguish gift, donum, from favor. Though Luther, so again, that's the objective side of God's utterly free utterance of forgiveness. But Luther, it seems, tries to hold them together. Favor and gift language in Luther, if we want to use Luther to interpret the confessions, it's not a bad idea. Favor and gift language is always held together, not separated. As if there's all, of course, there's no sense or self, no immediate self-understanding that he's trying to override subject-object split. It's just going on. The tensiveness, you know, that dialectical thing that's so genius to Luther, is there even in this, favor and gift. We see that spin out later in modernity, when modernity all the more exacerbates the subject-object split, and then when the definitions or theology of justification all the more formally in our doctrinal theology land on the objective side. I've already alluded that I use as a kind of a scapegoat there, but not entirely without warrant, Albrecht Ritschl, who wrote a very important three-volume treatise, you may recall, some of you, on the doctrine of justification. It became the definitive Western interpretation from modernity through virtually the latter quarter of the 20th century, as to what Luther really meant and what the Lutheran movement really meant in justification. I'm going to show you where Ritschl landed by counterposing a statement of his again with that one that I just read. I'll read it again. The idea of a divine life in Christ who is really present in faith lies at the center of the theology of the Reformer. Now, Ritschl said this, on the other hand, Right theological knowledge is transcendental in the sense that only effects of God's action in the world, not his being in itself, is accessible to us. There's the from a distance kind of theme going on. That modernist epistemology finally meant that not having Christ in us as the justified believer meant that there's really still, even after justification, nothing that we can do when it comes to fulfilling the law, when it would come to serving the neighbor, except to try to live a moral life toward Christ. What happens when you don't? Well, it's this endless cycle, or even endlessly sequential, epiphenomenal moment after moment, where we try, we blow it, we're forgiven, we're created anew. We try, we blow it, we're forgiven, we're created anew. All these kind of existentialist blasts on us, and supposing that there's nothing going on really in betwixt and between all of the existentialist blasts. Because, of course, if it's just justification forensically and not habitated in us, then there's really nothing real to attend to other than this poor moral individual. That's the curse of modernism. It stands starkly against any idea of conducting a regular practice of piety that would lead not only to embodiment of justification or expressed embodiment of justification in the believer, but also in the church. It's interesting to me that it was an Orthodox Lutheran who was very able to extemporize within scholastic methodology that a work of his, John Gerhardt, was very significant for early Lutheran pietism and a growth of a distinctive kind of Lutheran spirituality. One of the ways now that we systematicians try to get back at, find out what's going on there, of course, is we take a very lively and wonderful holistic sort of thing, an expressed spirituality, kill it, dissect it to see how it lives. So that's what I'm going to do here with respect to the thought of Johann Gerhardt. I would encourage you to look at his piece, a little devotional piece that's an extended meditation called Sacred Meditations, written, of course, in the 17th century by John Gerhardt. What John does there in that text is very much like conducting in print what has been done with us by Susan. So maybe, Susan, you didn't know it, but you're a happy example of 17th century piety. And I mean that in the most honored way, not as a museum piece. If we go back and look at that, particularly where he would, I'd encourage you to read it, I don't want to comment overly on it, where he would reflect on the Eucharist, you see some amazing things going on about the indwelling of Christ. Just a couple of examples. Just a couple of examples from John Gerhardt. His dates, by the way, are 1582 to 1637. If you want a capsule understanding of him, go to the book called Historical Dictionary of Lutheranism by Gossman, Oldenburg, and Larson, and see the article on John Gerhardt. So thus I slip in a little pitch there, self-servingly. He's very important as a systematician who wrote 9 volumes that got toward Aristotelian metaphysics, but that really, for him, the most important text, as well as for others, was his Sacred Meditations. What he believed was this, and here comes that word again. He believed that all theology is fulfilled in mystagogy. Let's all say it together. All theology is fulfilled in mystagogy. All right, we've got our word for the age there. Faith is the genuine union with Christ. Where Christ is, there is the grace of God. Where Christ is, there is God's favor. Hear those terms? It's an important point. as the recognition of the favor of God made emphatic in the forensic understanding of justification, already for Gerhardt presumes Christ's presence. That's an intuition, of course, that was neither evident in nor ruled orthodox by that Gnasio party in the settling of the form of Concord Article 3. So the argument here is that forensic language describes the consequence of faith in Christ, as Gerhardt put it, which is already given as reality in the person of Christ himself, in the gift of Christ's presence, the habitatio Christi, the habitation of Christ within the believer. Gerhardt's meditation on the Eucharist really gets at that nicely. Hear this. Nor does Christ simply speak the word of comfort to our souls. He also takes up his abode in us. He feeds our souls not with heavenly manna, but what is far better, his own blessed self. Christ holds us dear because he feeds our souls with so dear and precious food. He holds us dear because we are members of his body, of his flesh. And so we read of a sacramental realization of what Gerhardt elsewhere describes as our justification, that Christ is united with us by grace through faith, and that our new estate is not simply a consequence of a distant pronouncement. Now, I probably would demur from Gerhardt just a little bit in using any consequence language as if it's sequential. I want to say it's the whole package. It's gift and favor, and one really starts to go astray, and needlessly so, when you try to figure out which came first. It's a little deeper than a chicken and egg question. Before, our help was in the death of Christ. Now our help is in his life. Once we were dead in our sins, now we are quickened with Christ. We are quickened with Christ. Love that older King Jamesian term. We are enlivened with Christ. Well, I'm going to hyperlink sidebar here again to something else. Does that mean we weren't alive before Christ? Well, of course not. There's something biologically going on, to be sure. But what I'm pressing for is the proposal, and only that, that biological life, of course, is adequate for certain things, but Christian life is pressing toward more, what Jesus calls abundant life. And that more not only has to do with all the more embracing humanity and getting comfortable down deep, even in the edginess of the universe, on the edge of chaos, but that more has to do with becoming persons again for and with each other. For if Christ is in with each and every one of the believers, there's a sense in which there's a ongoing transaction, relation, isn't there, among the individuals? It's sort of that divine red thread, although I would not want to reduce it to just a common denominator, that has us as Christ talking to each other and recognizing that something is going on in creation that is an ever larger embodiment, an ever larger God-given definition of what it means to have a body. A body here demands, as justified body, demands community. And a community demands an ecology of community of communities. And that ecology demands a world and so forth. Something gets ever larger and larger when we press this matter of Christ in us. Does that annihilate the individual, though? No. Again, it would annihilate if we think only in terms of the subject pole or the object pole. I think there's something more wonderfully paradoxical going on, not unlike the persons of the Trinity. And that is, let's take a human relationship. One friend to another, soulmates, lovers to each other, are, of course, individuals who give yourselves over to the other and receive from the other. What happens there? Well, you become more a couple, or whatever unit we're talking about, you become more a community, but you also simultaneously become more yourselves. You are more personal more person, more identified, while you are also more community. The individual is not slaughtered, is not annihilated. The individual is ever heightened along with the community, with the give and take. That seems to be what's going on here too, when justification, now thought broader than some kind of moral pronouncement, means something almost metaphysically so about the ongoing creation of God's universe. So I've very quickly gone on, back from the hyperlink, to an assertion that justification is a mode of creation, and that we would be fateful, fatefully deeply in error, were we to separate too much the matter of redemption from justification, from doctrine of creation. Justification is something like a creatio continua. And God requires this justification now of a broken humanity, so all the more to continue God's grand creative project of ever more expansive community, which, again, does not slaughter or annihilate, but enhances and ever more gifts the individual to be just that, a person. It's ever more personal. Now, one other person, I wish I could say a lot, because he was integral, in fact, foundational to Wartburg Seminary's own existence, but to much of what's going on missiologically in the country and around the world, and to the birth of Missouri Synod as well, and that's the work of Wilhelm Leia. In the Midwest, for whatever reason, they say Leia. Good Germans would say Lua. But I'll probably show now that I've been thoroughly contextualized and use the non-German pronunciation of Leia. Wilhelm Leia was a very fine, brilliant pastor in a little village of Neuendettelsau, Germany, in the mid-19th century. He was a very fine theologian, got stuck to a post that he really didn't want, but his social skills with his superintendent and bishop and such ensured that he would stay where he didn't want to be. He had a penchant for continually writing some fairly slanderous stuff back to the authorities, telling them how they are really messing up things, either administratively or theologically. So we have an interesting, grumpy father of Wartburg Seminary there. But once he got planted in his place and said, well, there's no way out here, there's no exit, you know, the kind of pre-Sartrean way, Leia decided he's going to make the best of it and established the diaconal movement, planted hospitals, established a missionary society that sent people all over the world, heard about this place called North America where the Native Americans needed evangelization, so sent some young bucks at the fulsome age of 23 each to North America, particularly Michigan, to evangelize Native Americans. They found out that they weren't contextual enough to really make it happen. So he said, okay, link up with those French trappers and those Germans and those Irish who are settling down there in the Midland on this thing called the Mississippi River and go from there. And they did. They started a college and seminary and went on and also were very formative with respect to the Missouri Synod, as I said. Enough about that Chamber of Commerce stuff now out of the way. Leia was very effective because he pushed something against the prevailing Richelian mode. And that was to say that Lutherans are to be an embodied presence of justification. So he called his movement really one of sacramental Lutheranism. Sacramental Lutheranism as a term in the latter 19th century would be an odd thing to hear indeed. It's what made him all the more distinctive, not only because of his curmudgeonliness. True Lutheranism, Leia said, is corporate practice and sacramental life. It is bodily creation. And bodily creation is sanctified through public presence of a bodily people with a distinctive corporate way of life. The priestly vocation of God's people is not simply to save souls, but to redeem creation by fashioning a new embodied life together centered in worship. The crafting of such a life is the great art of the priestly people. It's the gospel work par excellence. Sacramental Lutheranism contrasts with a gospel of pure acceptance that simply tells the individual without any change that you're okay, and you'll be okay the next time we have to tell you you're okay. Now, I'll leave it at that and just encourage you to check out Wilhelm Leah. He clearly is one who stood against some of the metaphysical presumptions of the day and wanted to make, even liturgically so, some claims about divine metaphysics, within which justification is an integral mode, process. I just want to think out loud. These are exploratory pieces now, but think out loud as to where this might cohere, if nothing more than that, with some of the things we've been centering ourselves around vis-a-vis the sciences these days. First of all, I don't think I need to say too much about this. Already with respect to entanglement and how everything really does affect everything else, the chaos that is part of chaos theory that is part of that, you readily could draw some inferences, I'm sure. One thing we've not talked about explicitly is the matter of complementarity itself, you know, wave-particle duality. But simply to note here that another fundament of the scientific understanding of the world is that light and, in fact, everything, you and me, are a necessary binary complementary bringing together of waves and particles. That if you do this famous two-slit experiment of trying to William Tell-like take a particle gun, as I drastically oversimplify it, shoot it through a little slit way over there, you want to measure the particles, what you find out is you get a smear on the recording plate behind it, and you find out that while you invited a particle to the party, it crashed the party with all of its friends. Or when you try to measure for all of the friends for the wave-like behavior, you might get perplexed because then the particles will come at you. It's almost a kind of a deliberately creative, fanciful kind of way of trying to outguess us, trying to confuse us, to surprise us continually. Well, all we can say out of that is we know that wave-particle duality is necessary. That's just the way it is. You get all of it as well as you get a part of it. You have individual, you have community. And that's all the more tightly so when you think about the entanglement side of all of that. Well, how about another theme? And we'll perhaps even try to work together in our conversation as to some of the implications we can draw. Another theme, that in justification, where God gives us God's self, according to Luther, we find out that God also then not only gives us a community, God gives us communities of communities, God gives us an ecology, God gives us a world, and with a world, God gives us time. I would want to pose out loud, because we sort of got into this last night, whether there's something possibly new happening here, that even in justification, as with creation, where, as is noted, Augustine rightly stated, time comes along with the creation, sort of a package deal along with matter and motion, that time in a new way is given to the believer. We might know that at least affectively as hope. Maybe there's a time above time or a larger time or even a complex, an embrace of temporalities given to us now by the promise of eternity. I'm just wondering out loud. What Paul calls hope is what one metaphysician of the late 20th century, Ernst Bloch, said was absolutely constitutive for life to exist at all. In justification, God gives hope, God gives time that's larger than entropy, thermodynamical time, which seems to promise only death. So whatever God is doing with time, it's something that's more than death. Okay? Or how about with Leah, corporate practice as an embodied reality? He says that's no static thing. That's ever a discipline, ever a practice of spirituality. But the soft science work of Pierre Bourdieu, a premier sociologist philosopher of sociology in France. Bourdieu is not known much yet here in the United States, but if you did a search engine thing, you'd come up with an amazing amount of material. He's one of the first people that the press in France always goes to when they want some academic to comment on a matter of state or ethics or politics and so forth. At any rate, Bourdieu has two very interesting notions of field and habitus. And I hope I'm not picking this up only because they happen coincidentally to be words I've already used, like habitatio Christi and so forth. For Bourdieu, a field is a general sociological principle that generates and unifies all practices. This will be kind of complicated, so just sort of try to get the general ethos of it. Don't worry about having to understand every little word here. He says the principle, a field, is the principle generating and unifying all practices. It is the socially informed body with its tastes and distastes, its compulsions and repulsions, with all its senses, that is, not only the traditional five senses. Look here how Bourdieu, as a sociologist, is trying to do something more holistic and not reductionistic, as sociology had been theretofore. Not only the traditional five senses, but also the sense of necessity and the sense of duty, the sense of direction and the sense of reality, the sense of balance and the sense of beauty, common sense and the sense of the sacred, tactile sense and the sense of responsibility. That's an interesting apposition. Business sense and the sense of propriety, the sense of humor and the sense of absurdity, moral sense and the sense of practicality, and then in a famous French phrase, and so on. Well, what might we think of with respect to Bourdieu's reflection on field and habitus, a habitus as that practice to which we return so often that as even a language analyst like John Searle out of the Western kind of Oxford tradition, though at Berkeley, says becomes sort of a normal, natural, intuitive response, having done something so often that it becomes bodily memorized, even though if you cannot cognitively access it. Bourdieu is doing something like that with respect to something beyond senses, with respect to individual, as well as to the larger gathering together, who each in their own distinctive ways, their own habiti, bring together many different information bits that make up now the field of social habitus. Last night was really about the first time I'd started thinking about possibilities, and only as kind of redheaded impulsion of what trajectories might things like information theory lead us toward. John's conversation about pattern. I wonder if there's some coherence between the still new discovery and interest in mining the possibilities about information processing, communication, equal a concern as energy sharing. I wonder if there's something nicely coherent between that and the kind of social fields that Bourdieu is speaking about. And in other words, that we bring patterns of patterns, that now in a practiced, embodied community such as Gerhard or Leah envisioned in their own Christian discipleship, in their personal as well as corporate spirituality, something new might happen. Something new would happen that comes together in what David Ford, Cambridge theologian, has said is kind of a a practice of non-identical repetition. I love that phrase, non-identical repetition, with respect to whatever the corporate Christian body is up to. In other words, we're not just doing the same old thing day in and day out, as if it's really exactly the same thing that was done then, and that it won't be right unless we follow all of the rules handed down. It won't be right unless we pay absolute attention to the last jot and tittle of the script, so to make sure that it's objectively right. Rather, that's there. It's bodily memorized into the community, but now extemporized as non-identical repetition. And extemporized in kind of a non-cognizable relationship sensibility about the whole environment, the whole field that has all sorts of other components going on. What happens, for example, in Eucharist? Is it only a mnemonic exercise where someone, by repeating exactly the right words, does all that is needed to be done? Well, a minimalist version would say maybe in times of critical pastoral care, perhaps that's all you should do. But when it is a matter of understanding as a gathering of the embodied corporate expression of the body of Christ, a new definition of what it means to have a body, then there are all sorts of other things going on that the celebrant, the assisting minister, or each individual under herself or himself could never fully comprehend. I have this thing. I'm staring at my page because I can't see it anymore. some call this an ecumenical disease I have to get over yet, called presbyopia. There have been advertisements about it. So I've reached middle age, and I have not yet been able to remember to bring my glasses with me when I do these things. So I have to squint, if you'll permit me that, and read this piece just out loud, make sure I have it right. Suppose Eucharist is a focus of what Bourdieu called habitus. But those who are best at performing it may be unreliable guides in giving an account of it, because when you're inside of it, you can't be as holistic as you might want to be. Often, neither words nor confessed theology are helpful. Rather, one follows the practices of architecture, decoration, certain people gathering in certain ways, forms of dress, ways of welcoming or excluding, body language, music, and other nonverbal symbols. Such considerations complexify beyond the already complex theological discussions, but at least they suggest why so much Eucharistic theology seems to miss so many of the points which an immersion in the habitus tells us should figure into the discussion. Well, that's an interesting thing. In other words, it's kind of a Nike version of Eucharistic theology. Just do it. But recognizing now that all that practice, now sublimely contextually aware, is starting to refer to fields or patterns, like that pattern of sense of sacred and common sense, tactile sense and responsibility, humor and absurdity. There's something about pattern going on there that I think merits some reflection. I don't have more I could say upon that other than to suggest that the Eucharist would be a very interesting test case, and would, as well as be a very complicated test case, of how something dear in a sacramental way to Lutheran tradition can be amplified in understanding by accessing sciences, even the soft sciences, such as in this case, sociology. It's intrinsic to Christian faith that Christian faith is true to itself only by being freshly embodied in different contexts. That's kind of the life in the Spirit, in other words. And I would pose that, as I said, for eventual conversation. Well, there are a number of things here that might be newly seen in the Lutheran view. At the very least, if nothing else is to be remembered, let us try to put it this way, that there are numerous consequences of a doctrine of justification newly or perhaps once again seen as a matter of embodied theology, as a matter with some metaphysical consequences, and that perhaps when we do get obsessed, even with things ecumenical or other concerns about how is it that the thing seems not to work or does work, we might be obsessing because we're caught up too much on one pole or the other. And maybe it would take an objective other to remind us at least that it's objectively the case that the object and the subject are united. But somehow we always finally indirectly speak that as sisters and brothers who are called to the mutual conversation and consolation of the believers. Thank you. So, you want to go for some questions?
Sure, I thought first we'd have a test.
Okay.
No, I think we have about 15 minutes, and so the mics are available for you.
Not being up on my scholastic argumentation, could you go through that favor gift
thing
a little bit more?
Sure. Put it this way, at the risk of oversimplification, Article 3 of the Solid Declaration spends a lot of time, especially in the footnotes, trying to give a priority of God's favor of the would-be child in Christ over against God's gift of Christ, as if favor preceded the gift. So in other words, God had a will and then would find a way. And that sort of overly defined the debate then, as if it had to be one or the other. What I'm suggesting is that Luther landed on both together. And it does not behoove us to try to think, at least metaphysically, of favor before gift or gift before favor. Does that help wherever you went? Okay. Yes, sir.
I couldn't help but think, as you were talking about field and habitus, the tension that as a parish pastor I always have between what is the focus of worship? Is it for the saved, or is it for the lost? Is it for the visitor, or is it for those who know the habit? And even the mission of the church, is it for how much time and effort do we invest outside the church, and how much do we invest in terms of teaching, inculcating the habit? And I suppose it's the tension that's healthy, and that if we go too far one way or another, we'll lose something. Does that relate to field and habitus in any way?
I think so. I think what this also calls us to do, and maybe this is liberating news for many, is that this calls us back to just practicing the basics so that piety is embodied. And it just happens to be the case that fields are created with embodied practices, with habitus. So don't worry about explaining the habitus or the field. Just get the person. And here's where I agree with Lindbeck in the so-called narrative or Yale school. Just get to teaching the language, teaching the practice, exercising the piety. Why is it that life in early Lutheranism was characterized, by, like Luther showed, by attending to certain regular actions of worship in the home and for the individual, as well as in the larger corporate of the ecclesia, but that later somehow that was gutted, that there was no public expression of piety in such a way, no practice of memorizing the catechism or the Ten Commandments or, you know, take your pick. No practice even of fish on Fridays and so forth. These were helpful embodying kinds of things that had their own affective communicability. That is, they weren't things to be propositionally asserted. You just did them. And found out then that there was consequentially a vivid public expression and so an evangelical witness to the larger world of what was going on here.
If I'm going to do a search engine on it, I'd like to know how to spell it.
B-O-U-R-D-I-E-U.
Oh, just U. No X.
Pardon me?
No X there, huh?
No X.
Yeah, okay. The second thing is, would you run through that definition of field again?
All right. Put my glasses on. I got it. Thank you. Field is, it's a long quote, again, but for those of you who want to write it down, or I can provide you the text individually. Quote, the principle generating and unifying all practices. Dot, dot, dot. I didn't put the whole thing here. You didn't want that. The socially informed body, with its tastes and distastes, its compulsions and repulsions, with all its senses, that is not only the traditional five senses, but also the sense of necessity and the sense of duty, the sense of direction and the sense of reality, the sense of balance and the sense of beauty, common sense and the sense of the sacred, tactile sense and the sense of responsibility, business sense and the sense of propriety, the sense of humor and the sense of absurdity, moral sense and the sense of practicality, and so on. It was not to end this list of what constitutes field or pattern. Yes, sir.
Postmodern metaphysics sounds like an oxymoron to me.
No.
And I'd like you to comment on juxtaposing or doing metaphysics or metaphysical speculation in a postmodern understanding, which has a suspicion of meta-narratives, grandiose schemes, mm-hmm. with respect to truth claims, mm-hmm. suspicion, and what Berger and others have called epistemological modesty.
Yep, yep. Well, of course, you don't want me to do a full excursus on that. I would go this way. You rightly note that much of what is postmodern sensibility is the critique of the meta-narrative. Another way to put it is to say that there are no foundations. There are any number of folks, of course, who show, too, that postmodernity has not fully defined itself yet by still preferring to call themselves so, but only with respect. So call it a humble postmodernity or a critical postmodernity. We could go on with creative predications and qualifications of it, a critical postmodernity that will use some things but not others. I myself, frankly, fall on the side ultimately of a critical realism. I think that reference is more referential than not. I think we get more to something that's really going on there than do we not. To speak only apophatically, finally, with no sense of a closely direct reference, finally guts, it seems to me, the effectiveness or simply the presence of language itself. The whole point of that kind of extreme anti-foundationalist, of course, is in that bumper sticker from Berkeley Days of Old, still pops up in Dubuque, of question authority. Well, the problem with that is, on what authority can it tell me to question authority? So it leads me to my purely to my subjectivity. Something about my humanity wants to drive me out of that into a more transcendental realm. I think that's already a practical proof of the implausibility of sheer postmodernity. There's a song, okay? I'd be delighted to pick that up with you more, though. You write about something, so maybe we're in some kind of eclectic time where we take a few things, but not all of it. And again, that's why it's interesting to me that postmodernity, particularly in Gen Xers, whatever, you know, XYZ, or maybe we're back to A, when they would show very very evocative interest in going back to original sources, but not with the respect of saying so-and-so said it, and therefore it's authoritative, more so with the sense of communicating with the ethos in which that was placed, that original text. It's something more like a Gerhardt meditation on sacred matters that commends it. That's another hermeneutical thing that's really important to watch for, even in worship planning. when we are strategizing in our new mission ventures about how to reach out to those who are predicated by whatever a postmodern sensibility is. Boots.
Maybe this is the easier way to talk for a short person. I just had two comments. They're not really questions. But first was to thank you for your reference to William Blaya. I can't say it right either. Mm-hmm. But his contributions to Lutheran social ministry mm-hmm. in Europe and then here. I mean, his works were really the cradle of it, and I would hope still the heart of what the distinctive heart of what Lutheran social ministry is. So yeah. Thank you for that. And the other thought was a memory that was brought back to you when you were talking about Luther and this sense of embodiment of the Christ and taking in the Christ. Many, many years ago, I was in a small group that was studying with Bob Bertram, and we were studying Luther's concept of faith in his sermons, particularly in his later sermons.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also for you, Susan, because it fits so much with what you said. We found a lot of references to trust. Faith trusts the promises of God, as you've been saying. But even more, and I don't remember the German words, but they translated into receptivity. Faith receives the blessings of God. Faith receives the promises of God. Faith receives Christ. So it's a real active, indwelling thing that's going on, and that just became really important in his later sermons.
Thank you.
You referred a couple of times now to George Lindbeck, and I have a question about the third approach or fourth approach that he has to doctrines, which is the cultural linguistic approach.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in that narrative tradition, semantics is sort of pushed aside, and it's very much about syntax. Mm-hmm. It's about the words that we use, and it's about the grammar of religion.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the doctrine is just simply the grammar of a particular religion. Do you think that because of this postmodern era that it's just what religion is becoming to, and it was apparent, I think, in your lecture, is that it is sort of an exchange of opinions and views.
Yeah.
But there are no questions of semantics. Is this true or is it false?
Yeah.
We are just a negotiation or conversation club. Mm-hmm. And exchanging opinions.
Mm-hmm. That's nicely put. I think you've summarized what I've already tried to say, obviously in a different fashion. The gain in thinking narrative or cultural linguistic theory for doing theology is really in underscoring the absolute importance of catechesis. You do have to sort of learn the language game before you can know what it means. And so that's a good start. But then I am interested in what it means. I believe it has something to say syntactically about the real world. There's got to be more reference than not. And thus, I qualify myself, finally, with respect to the Yale School by pushing for critical realism. And in many places today, that sounds like a dinosaur sort of statement. It's out of fashion.
If justification by grace is the answer, then is not the problem self-justification?
Oh, of course.
So if we're going to apply justification to creation, do we not need to find how it self-justifies? It seems to me nature knows how to die in order to live,
mm-hmm.
with black holes and seeds,
mm-hmm.
and the decay and becoming at the quantum level.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm concerned, in another tact here, it feels to me like we as Lutherans have this tent of justification by grace, and we attempt to pull everything under it in a kind of self-justifying way.
Well, that's a very useful comment. Thank you. I think it's one we might want to personally pick up. I think I agree with you. Certainly, we're not called to tell nature what to do. But there is Romans 8, of course, which underscores that no matter how well nature's already self-justified, its future is wrapped up in our justification by grace through faith, or its future is deleteriously affected in our modes of self-justification.
And just a further question, where could we use the word sanctification in the process?
A good question, and I'm going to leave it at that. Yeah. Last question, I guess. Thank you.
I'm very interested in the model of jazz improvisation. And in order for a quartet to give different riffs for different people, they have to have a strong bond among each other and the ensemble, and then in the larger audience to feed off of that. Dave Brubeck said that Paul Desmond had never played Take Five the same way twice.
That's true.
Now, my question would be, doesn't this relate to creation, to adaptability, to change of forms in life? I mean, isn't improvisation a kind of a model from music that has wider implications?
Mm-hmm. That relates back to that term of non-identical repetition. So repetition finally becomes maybe even quite dissimilar to what was well back there in history. I'm glad you used the term. I usually use that analogy with when I talk about the Trinity. Instead, yesterday I talked about choral overtone, but jazz. Yeah, jazz is a favorite piece that I use as analogy too. Thank you. Thank you all very, very much. Yeah.